Welcome back to Scoreheads, the podcast that celebrates the music of your favourite films, TV shows and video games by going behind the scenes of the composing industry and having in-depth conversations with those that make the notes that emote. I'm John Brown, and joining me for each Scoreheads episode is my good friend, film music journalist Sean Wilson. This week, however, we're doing things a little bit differently. We're still going behind the scenes, we're still sitting down and talking art with an artist. However, this week, we're going to try something a little bit different as Sean Wilson and I speak with a composer not of music, but of sound. That's right, for this week's episode, we're going to learn all about the art of sound design in films from Mr. Johnny Byrne, the recent BAFTA and Oscar-winning sound editor and sound designer of the incredible film The Zone of Interest. Working regularly with cinematic masterminds such as Jonathan Glazer, Yorgos Lanthimos and Jordan Peele, Johnny's work as a sound editor and designer is a glorious collection of carefully crafted and innovational soundscapes that can be heard within many critically celebrated films such as Under the Skin, The Lobster, The Favourite, The Killing of a Sacred Deer, Ammonite, Nope, Poor Things and The Zone of Interest, for which, as we just mentioned, he won both a BAFTA and an Oscar. Recently, and just prior to his Oscar and BAFTA wins, Sean Wilson and I sat down with Johnny to discuss his amazing work. And Sean and I are very pleased now to welcome onto the show a master of sound. He is sound designer, supervising sound editor, and so much more for the outstanding film The Zone of Interest. Johnny Byrne, welcome. How are you doing, sir?
John, hello. I'm very good. And hello to you too, Sean. Thank you for having me.
Oh, you're very, very welcome. Thanks so much for joining us. And we want to talk about this incredible film you've been involved with. We're aware that you were also involved with Poor Things as well, which is a link back we'll talk about in a little bit. But before we do that, we'll dive into that shortly. But I think what would be great is if we could get to know you a little bit and learn your role within filmmaking and what it was that inspired you to want to be involved in the industry as you are today. So I thought maybe we'll start there.
Ooh, okay, rewind. That's tape. Get all the way back to, okay, I was at university and it was really boring. I was looking out the window and it was a business degree and I just thought, oh my goodness, and stopped doing that. And then I went and got a job as a runner working in a commercial audio post house. And I worked there for a few years, got a scar from a piece of editing razor blade. And then we moved into digital, and about 2 years in, I met a chap called Jonathan Glazer, who is a rather formidable director of our country and times. And he, along with him, I worked on many pop promos and commercials. And then about the turn of the century, he said, I'm going to do a film. It was his second film. And I'd like you to be the head of sound on it. And so can you please understand how to do that? And that was my kind of introduction into film, really. And I just absolutely loved, you know, the bigger format for telling a story, you know, that you can use 2 hours rather than 60 seconds, which was all I was allowed before that point.
Did you guys, if I'm not mistaken, work on a Jamiroquai video or two?
John did. I met him just after that. I missed that one. Uncle Rabbit in the Headlights was the first. The guy going down the tunnel and getting smashed repeatedly by the car.
Wow. I love Uncle.
Yeah, it's brilliant, brilliant video. Me and a guy called Tony Rapaccioli at Waves at the Tape Gallery did that in 1998, I think. But yeah, that, and then a couple of years later, we did the Guinness commercial with the guy surfing and amongst the horses and all of that.
Yeah, and, iconic advert.
Yeah,
and brilliant.
And then and having done that, we clean sweep many awards, and then thought, right, what next? And John had already done Sexy Beast around that time. But I think during the making of that, he didn't get the choice of his crew or anything, you know, or he hadn't gelled or anyway, for some reason, he forgot to ask me. But when it came to doing Birth, his 2003 Nicole Kidman amazing feature film, yeah, I got involved in that, basically.
So do I infer from that, Johnny, did you work on Under the Skin with Jonathan?
Yeah, I did. I did. Under the Skin was... So actually what happened with Birth was I didn't do an amazingly good job at it because I didn't understand what the difference was between a commercial and a... And so I had to get someone else to help me do the kind of the grown-up stuff. But Under the Skin was the second film that I did, but it was the first one where I was the head of sound and, you know, the chief supervisor kind of thing. So yeah, and that was... in fact, John said to me about 4 years before, okay, now find out what, you know, what it is you don't know. Understand what Foley is and how not to compress things. Because back in the day, adverts had so much compression on them. It was all about just making something as loud as possible and then parking it at full volume for the 30 seconds. So I tried to mix the first film I did like that, and that was awful. But yeah, so he said, find out what you need to know, and Under the Skin. And really, Under the Skin was a massive journey for John and I and a lot of his other heads of department, I think, because that's the crew that he now works with and on all of his stuff. But we were, a lot of us were kind of learning a lot of our techniques. And for me, that meant understanding that John didn't like stock sound effects and we couldn't use Foley created in a studio that, you know, using the flapping leather gloves to sound like a pigeon's wings. You know, all of that is no. It's go out in the real world and find something that is the real thing or as close as possible. Because certainly for John's style of cinema, true immersion doesn't come actually from sort of surround sound and all that whizzing and deep bass subtones. It comes from believing the sound that you're hearing, the kind of credibility of it.
Well, that's, given how strange the film is, that's a huge ask to go and find organic sounds for a film that's that surreal and that transcendent.
Yeah, no, with for Under the Skin, in order to kind of present the alien world as Scarlett Johansson's character saw it, it was necessary to go and find all the kind of weird sounds that you mentally block out and or that you wouldn't bother choosing to put into a film soundscape because they're not very interesting. People digging with shovels in the background. And I spent about 3 weeks walking around Glasgow with an umbrella. Oh, it's somewhere just there. This umbrella with a microphone stuck in the handle, and the microphone there, and the wire up my sleeve to a recorder. And if someone was talking in a loud voice, I'd yawn and stretch like that and pretend I'd have the microphone right in their face, kind of, so I could record a load of...
You actually just had a demonstration there.
Yeah, sorry.
In front of people listening.
Amazing.
But that was... And in that manner, I captured all sorts of fascinating thick Glaswegian accents and other strange oddity of sound that we put together. And we spent... Normally a picture edit might take many months, but the sound kind of gets stuck on by the sound department. But what John likes to do is have a sound edit that is kind of like a picture edit, where you also spend a good 3 months auditioning all the stuff you've got and trying ideas and then another sort of few months mixing it. So yeah, we spent 2 weeks just listening to all the recordings that we had, cataloguing it, and then deciding what were the bits that sounded a bit more unusual. And that was how we kind of presented the alien point of view in Under the Skin.
That's pretty insane. But what's the craziest thing you've ever had to do to achieve a sound for a project?
Oh my goodness. I'm going to steer clear of the zone of interest because that's crazy, not good. But wow, I mean, yeah, there's so many weird things on Nope. There was we had this amazingly talented room full of actors in Los Angeles, and we were asking them to scream like they were on a roller coaster having fun, and then when we would drop our hand, that would be the bit where they would suddenly have to sound like they were dying and or meeting a monster or meeting their maker. And I definitely remember at that point thinking that this is a really weird job I have. That's a very strange thing to be doing. Yeah, but generally I think in terms of practical strange things out in the world, I think probably I'm just always that guy on holiday who pulls a microphone out and the hotel and wonders what the beach sounds like. And, you know, so I'm strangely annoying my family constantly with that kind of thing.
Well, I was going to ask, and forgive me if this is a big question, for those who aren't in the know, what is a sound editor and what do they do and what is their primary responsibility when it comes to the film?
A film will have dialogue, which is all that tends to be all the sound that comes from the film shoot, and that'll be the production sound, and it's mostly the word spoken, the script said by the actors. And then there's sound effects that are things that you would stick on the film afterwards once you've been given the picture edited together, and that might be a really nice car sound or a car door or some cicadas in the background or crickets. And then there's Foley, which is when you decide that the plastic cup on the film set didn't make the right sound, so you get a nice chink of a real glass sound and you re-record that in a studio. And then there's music, and those four things are the sort of broad divisions, and each of them tend to have one editor, one person editing each of those things, and then someone called a supervising sound editor who kind of oversees all of that. And on lower budget films, that will be just one person doing the whole lot. and on bigger budget films where it has to move quicker and you might have a totally revised picture edit that you have to sort of present to someone tomorrow, then you need a bigger team of people to resync all the goblins' footsteps or bullets or whatever it is that have changed, you know.
What would you say is the best sound you came up with completely by accident?
Oh, wow. Completely by accident. I mean, do you mean like when I fell off a, what was it, like a audience? I remember as a kid falling off a thing at a fairground, and it was like a steps and tiered seating, and I fell about 8 feet and I was knocked out, but my brother said I made a really funny sound as I went
as I went unconscious. No, I never heard it.
Yeah, just through the, I mean, we shouldn't be laughing. Why are we laughing at that?
It's fine now, evidently.
Yeah.
The sound effect that got away.
Yeah, it's, but I mean, you know, through experimentation, I guess there's a lot of experimentation when you're looking for a specific sound that the film or project needs. But was there anything, you know, like we call them happy accidents or in the composing space, for example, you know, those wrong notes or. Yeah, and you go, oh, actually, that works. You know, that's what I mean by that.
Definitely. It's, you know, for me, when I begin working on a project, I never start putting anything onto the film until I have spent, you know, a good few weeks exploring all the different, I suppose in musical terms, it would be instruments that I'd use. But so that would involve, and a lot of it I'll do with just my mouth making, like the monster in Note was a kind of thing, but slowed down. And, so yeah, a lot of the time I'll just play around and it is exactly the happy accidents that make the unusual stuff, and that's entirely why I'll always go out, you know, with a microphone and record whatever it is. If it's you know, if I need a car, then I'll go and find the right kind of car. But most sound effects libraries won't have the sort of the rattly noises that a car actually makes and all those kind of unusual bits that make things sound different, basically. But what would I have done that would be, I mean, yeah, Ammonite was, I remember feeling slightly odd on that, because there's a scene in Ammonite when Kate Winslet climbs up this cliff and knocks a boulder down and it squidges down in the mud, and I had to roll around in a pile of mud in the cliffs down in Dorset that was pretty unusual and squelchy. But normally it's always about finding weird sounds by accident, and that's what makes things sound different. But that is also what makes the viewer think, oh, it's real, because real life is not like it is in a movie kind of thing, or at least in the way I do it anyway.
But also there's the composer in their comfy studio with an orchestra, and you're out here in the freezing cold and the mud and the wet. You're doing the real work, man.
Not fair, is it?
It really is.
But by the way, sorry, just to interject there about Nope, the sound in Nope is phenomenal.
Yeah.
Absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah, it's extraordinary, isn't it? I was so lucky. Jordan's such a talented musician, and he can really talk about sound, you know, he knows what frequencies are, and so he can be really descriptive, and he involved me months before filming, and you know, we discussed the script for a good few months really, and he put a fair few ideas in to do with, you know, how to convey the story with sound, so he was really up for doing it as a big sound number. It was brilliant. I was so lucky to work on that. It's an extraordinary film.
Could we, you just did a little demonstration of the jean jacket alien noise there. Could we just press you for that again? Like you said, you did it organically. What did that sound like again? The sound of the alien?
Hang on, it was kind of, I can't do it when I'm leaning over, but it's because most of the thing I did with Jordan was on a Zoom call. I didn't go to America for the first 5 months. So I was like, well, what about if we went kind of... And then... and... just like doing strange things like that. And the bit where the people get trapped inside the, me just rubbing a pop shield on this microphone here. Just, I mean, it probably doesn't come through because I haven't got the pop shield on, but it, you know, that rubbery sound was so much of Note was made with this microphone here and all the kind of and all those things. It was
that abduction scene in Nope is one of the most creepiest and most disturbing things, again largely driven by the sound and just absolutely completely overwhelming and immersive. That's we both find that absolutely fascinating, that how much residual texture of a film comes from all the organic nature of sound. That's really interesting, I think.
The other thing I'm always trying to do is always play it to the music. I mean, so I was very lucky that Michael Abels would, you know, he came down to the studio where I was working quite a few times, and we'd just play each other the work that we were doing, and he would say, okay, cool, I'll steer clear of those kind of notes, and then he'd play me the key that he was working in, and I'd say, great, well, I'll make sure the monster sounds harmonious with what you're doing. And so I'm always looking at, you know, any background sound or any sound at all, and thinking about its pitch and its rhythm and you know, how it's going to fit into, usually bending it to the music, because, you know, that should come first. I don't want to affect how the composer's making anything. But yeah, that's a huge part of it as well, the whole over thinking of the whole soundscape and how the whole thing works, basically.
Is that standard practice for a composer to play on the front foot like that? You know, because obviously there has to be a symbiotic relationship between the sound and the music. Is it quite commonplace that a composer will come up to you and say, well, there's a key change here, and we'll work around it and we'll collaborate on that?
I mean, it definitely depends how well you get on and how many awards they've got. I think it's... you've got to be polite about stuff but I've worked with Mika Levy, you know, really enjoyed working with them many times, and their input is extraordinary, and the way that they think about how a whole soundscape puts, it couldn't be done any other way than to be aware of each other's work, and you know, but then again, I've heard that some people hum a tune and you know, and then they'll have someone else write the whole thing from that, and you know, and I doubt they ever talk to the sound designer, but I wouldn't know who anyone like that would be.
that's just hanging there.
We're still gonna hang there. Yeah, that's fine. We're gonna just tiptoe past that. Now everybody's literally screaming at me, going, who? Do your homework. Actually, that took me back, and Sean, I appreciate that this will probably circle back around nicely to a question that you have about your relationship within the film and how the film's sound works. But I did very quickly, while I'm thinking about it, I did wonder if was there any... I was thinking about kind of legends in the sound industry and folks that came before you, and for example, Ben Burtt on Star Wars. Were there any icons or legends of the industry that you looked up to or do look up to and revere in that way?
Absolutely. I mean, it's really weird because I met some of them at the Oscars Sound Bake Off in Los Angeles a couple of weeks ago. But yeah, for 20 years ago, my brother gave me a signed photograph of Ben Burtt and one of Randy Tom. And I got to tell him like 2 weeks ago, I've had your picture on my wall up until a few years ago. But I think Walter Murch for me is the most extraordinary character and so, you know, knowledgeable about film and how a film works. And, you know, and he's such a capable, an incredible picture editor as well, let alone sound editor, and the phrase sound designer was coined for him, and yeah, so he and all of his work, you know, I mean, The Conversation is such an extraordinary film for sound, as well as, you know, the obvious Apocalypse Now and all that stuff, but yeah, so definitely Walter Murch, what a hero.
Sure. Oh, actually, before I pass you back to Sean, is that what I think that is behind you? That is that from Nope, the picture?
Jordan gave me that, yeah. It's that's
amazing.
So that turned up in an enormous box. It took two of us to get it in the house. But it's when the opening titles of Nope, they printed out onto card the 14 or 12 frames of the original Muybridge clip, the first ever piece of film taken. And so that's one photograph of the set of 12 that they used to film with the IMAX camera to make the front of the film. So that's like an original still or whatever of the Muybridge clip kind of thing.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's good bit of art for the wall.
Well, evidently, Johnny, we're primarily here to talk about The Zone of Interest, which is an extraordinary piece of work driven by some astonishing work from you, and evidently what the film does brilliantly is that what is implicit in terms of the visuals is made totally explicit by what we're hearing on the edge of the frame. And I wondered, like, it's a really interesting, the movie puts us in all sorts of conundrums in very, very fascinating and obviously intentionally uncomfortable ways. But I wondered, in your role as a sound editor and sound designer, what is it that's disturbing about us hearing it rather than seeing it?
It is, isn't it? It is disturbing. And I think it's a few things, but primarily as John said to me at the beginning, I never want to go in the camp and show the atrocities because people already know what those images look like, and there's no benefit to extending that any further. He said, but what we can do is we can draw images in people's head with sound based upon their knowledge. And frankly, that's more horrific because John can't put an image in your eyes that is worse than the one that you can paint with your own head anyway, because it's more kind of personal to you. So there's that. And also, I think there's something that we believe sound more than image. You know, if you're watching a movie and the picture's cut out a bit, it's not half as annoying as if the sound does for some reason. And I think that's to do with the fragility of the suggestion of sound. And it's... But basically, you can fool the eyes a lot easier than you can fool the ears. And I think a third thing is that... the ears are hotwired to the limbic system, and so that comes in before you actually do any logical processing of it, whereas the eyes spend a bit more time being processed by the brain, and I think it's much more easy for you have a much quicker and more instant reaction before your body can tell you that everything's okay. If you see what I mean. I didn't explain that very well, but yeah.
No,
sounds scare you in a way that images don't.
Yeah.
That was very good. I was just thinking about how actually some of the techniques and some of the sounds that we are hearing in the film and just kind of how you arrived at such brilliant sound design.
Well, when discussing it with John, we sort of came to see it as there will always be two films, one that you see and one that you hear. And the one that you see is a family drama, and that's people in a house, Big Brother style, everything in mid shot with a kind of a critical distance of feeling voyeuristic and never getting too close to anyone, but hearing the sounds kind of people in a house, teacups and all, as opposed to just the kind of words that you normally get in a film. So that was about capturing, hiding microphones inside the house and making sure we captured the sound of people in a house more than a mic on an actor. And then... But what you were asking about, sorry, was the sound design in the film. And John said, I'm going to go and film this film in Poland and I'll be back in about a year. And when I am, you need to be an expert on what Auschwitz sounded like in 1943. And you need to be able to play that to me, you know, what you think that is, mm-hmm. basically. So how I went about that was, well, I tried to run away, but he wouldn't let me. And then... Mm-hmm. I decided, you know, research really. So it was all about finding all the, every understanding about the birds and the bees and the bicycles and the motorbikes and the weaponry that they used was from the First World War because the good stuff went to the front line and those sort of things, and making sure that we had accuracy around things like that and the types of reconnaissance planes and things. But primarily it was about reading witness testimony and reading, you know, all the novels I could on Auschwitz and everything about that period in time, and specifically the Auschwitz Memorial Archive, which has a great deal of stuff that isn't published. But so that was about just reading and reading and reading, and anything. There was quite a lot of specific things where it might say a sound related thing, like, the electric fence would make a horrible buzzing, screaming noise, but it was quite quiet. But when someone chose to end their life, it would really clang and rattle, and so there were often descriptions of really horrific things purely in sound, but the bulk of my research was just listening, reading stories and understanding what that might have sounded like. And so basically literally copying and pasting things into a large document and using each one of those little stories as like a script that I would then have to go and record a kind of radio play of to be able to play that to John, you know, in a few months time kind of thing.
How did you feel, how, you know, having to research that, it must have been absolutely harrowing in a way to sort of get much deeper into the truth of such horrors, but then be able to have to recreate them in a you know, soundscape kind of way. How did you feel?
Yeah, it was awful. I mean, it really was awful. I don't think any of us really enjoyed working on it, apart from John and I are very good friends, and as I am with the picture editor, Paul LaMica, and so there was certainly camaraderie and I enjoy their company very much and we hung out every day on a daily basis, but the work that you're doing was not great. And I think certainly some of us have felt down about it. But, you know, we weren't there, and it's a story that needs telling, and so
yeah,
that's all good. Glad we did it, but I don't want to do it again. Yeah.
Yeah.
In fact, I was really lucky because I was thinking of calling my doctor and saying, can I have some antidepressants, please? But fortunately, Yorgos got there first and said, can you come and mix Poor Things, which was the same thing, and I had a break. I had, like, a month and a half hole where I went and did something really fun.
Your work on Zone of Interest, it's recently, the release of the film has recently overlapped with the 79th anniversary of the Auschwitz liberation. That came up recently. But what I thought was very interesting and very powerful in the film was the sound has a narrative of its own. It's still, from the beginning of the movie, you start with the black screen and Mika Levy's music, and then you cut the riverside scene, which looks like a bucolic family outing. And then you build from the background. Okay, this is not what it seems. Because I was trying to think of, if someone were to come into the movie not knowing what the context of the movie is, did that cross your mind in terms of like building a sound from someone who just walked into the movie blind, like not really knowing what it was about?
What was that a consideration to?
Yeah.
I suppose, I mean, probably not. I don't think I could. That would be a hard one to because you'd be making compromises for such a, but I do think there was a really weird thing that we would experience, that if you mix it for, like, you know, 3 months, then on the beginning of week two you might want to start 20 minutes in, but whenever we did, we would find that everything was too loud, because it's only by the experience of playing the film through from the beginning that we ourselves dial out certain sounds as we're watching it. So we certainly found that we had to play it from the beginning. And if anyone did walk in the movie theatre halfway through, they would think, Jesus, this is all a bit loud, because that's sort of what goes on. But yeah, so yeah, you're right. It definitely is experienced differently if you come in halfway.
Because it's obviously what you're hearing is obviously mutable and organic relative to where we are in the house, isn't it? Relative to where the camera is pointing, whether you're tracking with the characters, whether you go out into the garden, and all these acoustics and layers are all enveloping, but they're constantly changing. I thought it was just an extraordinary piece of work. So much consideration went into it. I mean, how do I understand it right that you spent a year building up bank of, like, sounds, though? Is that right?
Absolutely. It was very necessary to do so, because sound in the real world is so completely layered. And what we wanted to create was more of a documentary thing than often in a film. You'll focus on the dialogue and then all the background sound, even if the car engine will be taken out or there'll just be music. And it's unnatural, but that's the conceit that people are used to. But here, I think one of the reasons this film is so unusual and different is we absolutely put in all the real sound that you would normally hear. And for example, for the family drama side of the soundscape, not hearing, apart from everything that came from the camp, when it was filmed, there was actually, simultaneously, there would be scenes going on in different rooms in the house at the same time with all the different hidden cameras. And Jonathan wanted the actors to really feel like they were in 1943, so no crew were allowed on the set. There was no people holding boom mics or anything. Everything was hidden and tucked away, and the takes were about an hour long each, because that was the length of the memory stick in each of the cameras. And that was, you know, and so they just roll and let them get on with it. And so the picture edit was cutting that down. But we had, you know, if the nanny with the baby would walk out of the kitchen and go upstairs, you know, we'd actually really hear that, and I'd have a continuous 1 hour microphone of, you know, from all the different microphone positions in the house, and I could make sure that the sound in the house was constantly a multi-layered thing, and that where you'd always hear the other room, and you would always hear the kids outside, and you would always hear a car on the road. And so even camp sounds aside, just the feeling of being in the house, I think, was really hugely immersive. And we were lucky that what they were actually saying wasn't so important, because the reason you wouldn't do that normally is because you want to hear the dialogue and you want to go close on someone's face and feel the kind of pathos of this monologue or whatever. But that's not the case here. It was observe these people, stand back and look at that. And so we made that. And then on top of that, we then made in huge amounts of layering of sounds from the camp. And that was all based around, basically I had a map that was a large Google Maps photograph of the whole camp area, but all with, you know, with a grid so that I knew exactly how far all the distances were. And I knew that, say, for example, block 11 was 100 metres away, and that was where there were, during this time period, about 80 executions by gunshot per day. And so we recorded gunshots at about 100 metres in a environment. There's a firing range on the Isle of Wight that has the right kind of buildings to give the right sort of slap reverb. And so we did that. We knew that the prison, the building nearest the garden, was a guardhouse. So we recorded, for example, we went to out in Berlin at night, and we recorded drunken people out. And, it, you know, you're not actually hearing their words, but you're hearing the tone of their frivolity and joyfulness. And then we went to football matches in fourth division leagues with no spectators in rural Germany, and we would record kind of young men shouting. And we went to there were some riots in Paris, pension reform riots, and we went and recorded the sound of French people not having a great time, because we knew that, you know, on my map, I from my research, I understood that during that period of time, the nearest block to the nearest prisoner block was a French block, and so there was a lot of harassment of French people going on, and that was an important characteristic to put in the sound, and it always had to be kind of at that position at the end of the garden. So very scientifically, in terms of the tonality of how sound works and how it fades over time, and how reverb accumulates as distance extends, and all those sort of things. So yeah, a few layers, yes.
Must be hours and hours and hours and hours and hours of work bringing that all together, Johnny.
I mean, definitely 6 months of research, of just reading, and then a year of going out and recording stuff on and off during the production, and then during the kind of filming period, and then a year to before any sounds of the camp were put on, a year just to edit the picture and put the sounds of the house together and make the film work without the horrible horoscope, and then about another 4 months of putting the horoscope on, and about another 2 months of fine-tuning the mix and balancing everything. So yeah, a couple of days.
But you say that following on from that, you went to Poor Things, which I imagine was slightly more uplifting in that respect, of course, because that's now there's a film that is, I say, obviously I want to talk very delicately around films that are fun to work on, but of course this must have been incredible fun to work on, Poor Things. Tell us more about your experiences on that.
Oh God, it's so funny, and Emma Stone's performance in it is so fantastic, and it kind of makes the film and the the set designs. And so I worked with Yorgos for, this is our fourth film, and I did The Lobster with him, and then I did Killing of a Sacred Deer, which I think was in like 2016 or something. And when we started the sound process of that, he said, oh my goodness, I've just got the green light. Emma Stone's come available, so we're going to go and film The Favourite. And so he had to leave and didn't have any part in the kind of post-production sound process of Killing of a Sacred Deer. And I tried to get him to come listen to it, and he didn't have time. And so he heard it at the Cannes Film Festival at the premiere. And that was pretty much, bar a few little bits of checking, the first time he heard it. So I was very sweaty on that night. But what did mean that we got a lot of confidence. And it really taught me something about, because I spent a lifetime saying to directors, do you like A, B or C? And I had to think, oh no, now I'm the director really. And I'm just, you know, I need to be, think like a director who happens to wear the sound hat. And that really taught me a lesson about making right choices. And so Yorgos now says to me, well, you know what you're doing, you can, you know, just put the sound on, you're the sound guy. So he showed me the rough cut, and in fact I saw the set designers made a PDF that was full of artwork and stuff, and that gave me a real understanding that the soundscape needed to be quite surreal, because, you know, because the imagery was, and so when I saw that and Emma's performance and everything, I thought, wow, yeah, it's got to be quite over the top and quite funny. So yeah, what a laugh to work on that, and what a relief.
Well, what an absolute pointed contrast with The Zone of Interest as well, because obviously there you are dealing with the sobriety of real life and history, whereas in Poor Things you're dealing with a complete steampunk fantasia, which is completely, you know, invented. Obviously you're dealing with human characters, but everything is completely carnivalesque and hilarious and surreal. And is there a sense of, you know, when you're dealing with a world like that, that it's more like from the ground up, you are having to think of like inventing things that sound plausible but can be more exaggerated.
Yeah, I mean, basically, you've got to make it sound normal. And so my mother once said to me, "What do you mean you do the sound on films? They sound all right to me." And so she has to remain constant, well, God rest her soul, with that thought. But so in order to make sound that sounds normal over really extraordinary images, you have to make choices that are seemingly wrong. Like, for example, in Poor Things, there's a ship, and the sound of the ship is a heartbeat because that, to me, felt right. And it gave it a kind of quirky little funny rhythm. And you could play with that along with Bella Baxter, the character's character and mood. But, you know, but a chug of a sort of cross-channel ferry would have sounded really dull and made the film feel long because it's not that kind of thing. So, yeah, it's absolutely about misappropriating sounds and making it unusual.
I have to ask the question because it's... I'm going to not forgive myself if I don't ask it. But when you're tasked with making sound for a picture, and let's say it would be a human being's response to be embarrassed by certain sounds or certain things that happen within films, and let's take sex as a case in point. But how does one work with that in a sound design context? And is that something that could be a little bit uncomfortable, or is it something that mostly quite amusing? Or how does one work with that in a context of film?
I mean, God, I one of my favourite things is to play the fart gag on an unsuspecting director. You know, like one of the characters leans over in the film and you're in a big mix room and you just throw a little poop in. I did that on Under the Skin, and unfortunately we sent Scarlett Johansson a viewing copy. The first time she ever watched it, I by mistake left a fart gag in.
Oh.
When she got in the van, there was a... So when I got to the Venice Film Festival, she was like, Johnny Byrne, right, yeah, so you're the guy who sent me the fart gag, right? Yep. So I don't know, there's that aspect.
I would have loved if she'd have campaigned for it to stay in the film.
Yeah.
It makes everything more human.
Oh, we did consider it. I mean, it would have thrown the whole movie at that point. It would have changed the cut. Yeah. But, you know, it's probably worth it for the fart gag. Believe me, John and I did consider it. but I don't know, I've done a lot of silly scenes. I mean, yeah, in Poor Things we spent a lot of time rattling bedsteads and, you know, and shaking old chairs to make a creaking noise and all of that kind of stuff. And so I think it's funny, it's silly, but no, certainly I don't get embarrassed and I don't, yeah, there's yeah, it's just fun, isn't it?
More comedic, I guess, when from a working point of view. Like, I imagine, like, slapping wet carrier bags full of water and things like that.
Yeah. Well, there was a lot of hose pipes filled with washing up liquid and water to get bubbling sound of, you know, Godwin Baxter at the beginning of the film. He sits there and his father had taken out his digestive system to see what happened. And so he has to have an external digestive device. And so that was fun to make sound for.
Well, we mentioned at the top of the episode that we'd spoken to Jerskine Fendricks about his remarkably unusual and striking score for the film. But in this instance, in Poor Things, it's interesting, isn't it? Because very often the music attains sound-like qualities that maybe intentionally don't sound musical. That seems to be the whole point. So it seems to be like a sort of holistic sort of onslaught of sound effects and music that sound-like, I imagine.
Absolutely. I mean, I definitely like to blur the line as much as possible, and Jerskine's score is incredible, especially, you know, for a debut score as well. How about that? And it's so full of his successful attempts to subvert common conceptions of how an instrument sounds, you know, like, so, you know, the bassy stuff and the you know, and the different kind of wind instruments that he used. But certainly wherever his score would end during a scene, I would just make sure that the residual background sound would somehow very faintly carry that pitch along. And you know, just those little things like that to make it all a bit more glued together kind of thing.
We're almost out of time. I do, Sean, if we move to you for the last question in a second, but I did want to ask the question of, obviously you've got these two phenomenal projects for very different reasons out now in UK cinemas, but What's next for you? What are you working on at the moment that you can talk about, of course, but what are you looking forward to? You having a rest? You throwing yourself back into it? What's happening with you next?
So the day after the Oscars ceremony, I'm starting work on mixing a film starring The Weeknd. And that is, really good fun. It's a really extraordinary film. And with a lot of really cool music in it. And it's, so that will be, yeah. And I'm really looking forward to that because it's an enormous, enormous soundscape of, you know, many different influences of music and sounds. And I'm mixing it in Dolby Atmos and it'll be pretty crazy. Yeah. And I'll get to play pool with The Weeknd. So that'll be good.
Yeah. My final question, I just wanted to underline how impactful and just brilliantly thought through your work on Zone of Interest is. It's a film unlike anything I've seen before, and so much of that is driven by the music. And I wondered, like, as a project that you've worked on, how does it sum up the suggestibility of sound? Like, what is the power of sound in order to do that for us?
How does it sum up that? I mean, I can't think of another film that uses sound to such a length to suggest a narrative. And certainly if you close your eyes, you are hearing a completely different, you know, you're watching in your head a different film to the one you see with your eyes open. And so I think, therefore, it suggests that, you know, like we were saying earlier, I mean, you know, you believe your ears more than your eyes. And I think certainly I'd love it if more directors understood or explored the whole counter-narrative thing. And, you know, that sound doesn't just have to do what the pictures are doing.
Johnny, thank you so much for your time. It's been amazing to talk to you, sir. Thanks for coming on. Good luck with everything you're doing next and wishing you all the very, very best, sir.
John, thank you very much. Lovely to talk to you. Thank you, Sean.
Awesome.
There we go.
Everybody good?
Great. Do it for real now, yeah?
Great rehearsal, guys. Well done.
And that brings us to a close for this latest episode of Scoreheads. Thank you so much again to Johnny and to Sean. And thank you too, as always, for listening. The Zone of Interest and Poor Things are still currently playing in cinemas, of which you can, of course, see them at Vue. And many thanks again to Vue once more for their support with this and every show. To find your nearest Vue, head on over to myvue.com. Or, if you can't reach a cinema just now, then The Zone of Interest is also available for digital download in the home or to rent. And Poor Things is now available to watch at home on Disney+. To get more updates from us, then by all means follow at Need a Bigger Pod on socials. I'm also at John Brown TV. That's at JON at John Brown TV on all platforms. Or you can follow Sean on X at Seano22. That's SEAN at Seano22. Or Instagram at Sean Filmwriter. That's all from us for now. As always, keep that soundtrack collection stacked very high, my friends. Until next time.